We've always tried to be very clear and upfront about this. It's frankly not a source of shame for Mary.
Confusion over discrepancies in Representative Mary Peltola's educational record. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 20th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, families are stuck abroad after the Marine Highway System pulled a ferry from service.
The ferry service called us and said that our ferry home from Prince Rupert to Ketchikan has been canceled, period.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
Among his many lies, Congressman George Santos of New York got elected while falsely claiming to have college degrees. So, reporters at USA Today set out to see if other freshman members of Congress are also misrepresenting their educational background. And today, the newspaper called out Alaska Congresswoman Mary Peltola. Her official congressional biography and her bio on the Alaska Legislature's website says that she attended the University of Northern Colorado from 1991 to 1994. USA Today says the university confirmed that she did attend, but left in the spring of 1993, not in 94. Peltola's deputy chief of staff, Anton McParland, says he's not sure why the congressional and legislative biographies say she was a student in Colorado until 1994.
To our knowledge, she was there until 93 and spent some of the fall of 94 working on a Republican state house race. We will work with those sites to resolve the confusion.
Although the discrepancy came to light because of the Santos scandal, Peltola's situation is different in important respects. For one, she did not claim that she had any college degrees. McParland, who was also Peltola's campaign manager, says as a candidate, Peltola made a point of saying on several occasions that she does not have a college degree.
We've always tried to be very clear and upfront about this. It's frankly not a source of shame for Mary.
Her bios say that after the University of Northern Colorado, Peltola attended the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, Southeast, and Anchorage from 1994 to 1998. She was elected to the state legislature in November of 1998. The Alaska legislature wrapped up its first week of the session today. Despite uncertainty going in, as of today, both chambers have elected leaders and determined their committee assignments. Joining us from Juneau to talk about what's been going on this week is Alaska Public Media statewide affairs reporter Kavitha George. First of all, Kavitha, how's the weather?
Oh, it's classic Juneau, rainy and windy.
Okay, good to hear. We can count on some things staying the same. Meanwhile, things in the legislature have been somewhat unpredictable this week, but now we can say the House is organized, right?
That's right. So we definitely went into the start of the session thinking that we could absolutely see a repeat of the last few cycles when stalemates in the House dragged on for weeks while representatives tried to form a coalition and basically no other legislative business could happen during that time. And I should mention, a coalition is a majority group of lawmakers, so you need more than 20, who band together, usually on ideology or shared positions on specific issues, to form the majority caucus. And then they're able to elect a speaker and decide on other leadership roles. And going into the first day on Tuesday, there was no established coalition, and the House adjourned without a speaker. And then somewhat surprisingly, on Wednesday, Wasilla Republican Kathy Tilton was elected House Speaker, and she announced that Republicans had formed a coalition.
Okay, so how did that all come together? I mean, what happened in the meantime?
So it looks like 19 Republicans, and that's all Republicans except Kodiak Representative Louise Stutes and Wasilla Representative David Eastman, joined forces with the Bush caucus to form a majority that's led by Tilton. And the Bush caucus is made up of four rural Democrats and independents. That's Bryce Edgman from Dillingham, C.J. McCormick from Bethel, Neil Foster from Nome, and Josiah Patkatak from Ukiagvik. Forming a coalition was always going to come down to folks in the middle, And Representative Foster noted yesterday that the Bush caucus has historically worked across the aisle with both left-leaning and right-leaning majorities. He said that they're really just focused on rural issues like power cost equalization and infrastructure.
So this is kind of a shift from the last few years when Democrats have mostly led in the House majority, right? Is that going to signal a change as far as what actions the House takes this year?
It does. You know, Tilton said that this is a coalition that is bound by shared policy goals. She's kind of repeated the phrase fiscal stability as one goal, but it's unclear what that really means. She did mention it could potentially involve a state spending cap. She said they also want to take a look at election issues. Some members of the majority have been a part of a Republican push to repeal ranked choice voting, for example. I'll also note that the majority as it stands now is very politically mixed. And I think one thing to watch where this could cause roadblocks is the PFD, because you have Republicans like Tilton, for example, who support a full statutory PFD, and then others like Edgman, who do not want to overdraw the permanent fund. House infighting has certainly been a theme the last few years, and I think representatives are pretty cognizant of that reputation. So everyone from Tilton to Bush caucus Democrats are saying that they're really committed to working together this session.
Right. And for now, we can pretend it's a nice, big, happy family. OK, so that's the House. What's going on over in the Senate?
Yeah, things are a lot smoother in the Senate. The Senate organized way back in November, so they've hit the ground running this week. The majority, and actually it's a supermajority, is led by Kodiak Republican Gary Stevens. And it's a broad 17-member bipartisan caucus, almost evenly split between Republicans and Democrats. Their priorities this year are upping funding for education, teacher workforce development, and restoring a defined benefit pension plan for state employees. There are three senators who are not in the majority. They are North Pole area Senator Robert Myers and MATSU senators Mike Schauer and Shelley Hughes. They were mostly left out of committee assignments, and that's because Schauer and Hughes in particular have ruffled feathers and not really gotten along with other members. Senator Stevens said this week that they could revisit committee assignments later in the session if Schauer and Hughes prove themselves easier to work with.
This is all very interesting. So technically, there are bipartisan majorities in both chambers, but it sounds like the House leans further right. How are we anticipating the Senate and House working together, though?
So the House and Senate work in tandem on legislation and on the budget. So even though work on these issues might start independently in each chamber, at some point, the other chamber is going to have to sign off. And both sides are going to have to make some judgments on what they can get past the other one. For example, the Senate has already indicated that they are not interested in repealing ranked choice voting, which does not bode well for those efforts in the House. The PFD is also likely going to have a lot of back and forth as well. Senator Stevens said this week that he doesn't think the state can afford the $3,800 dividend that Governor Dunleavy proposed last month. And we already talked about some of the conflicting interests in the House there. So I'd say strap in for some robust discussions.
We certainly will stay tuned. Thanks for joining us, Kavitha, and stay dry.
Thanks, Casey.
That was Alaska Public Media's statewide affairs reporter, Kavitha George, in Juneau. Sitka Superior Court Judge Jude Pate has been appointed to the Alaska Supreme Court. Governor Mike Dunleavy announced Pate's appointment today. Pate was selected from a list of four attorneys and judges nominated by the Alaska Judicial Council in December. Pate was Sitka's public defender for over a decade, from 2006 to 2017. Before that, he worked as in-house counsel for the Sitka Tribe of Alaska and as a private practice attorney. He moved to Sitka in 1993 after earning his law degree at Lewis and Clark Northwestern School of Law. 5 years ago, Pate was appointed to serve as Sitka's Superior Court judge by then-Governor Bill Walker. In an interview with KCAW Radio in 2018, shortly before he was sworn in, Pate discussed how he'd handle the transition from lawyer to judge.
Yeah, it's going to be a change for a baseball player to become an umpire, but it's a different job. Maybe you'll miss the thrill of the chase, but I'm looking forward to a different role and experiencing a different side of the law.
Pate was in court today and could not be reached immediately for comment. He will fill the vacancy created by Chief Justice Daniel Winfrey's retirement. Governor Dunleavy has also named the Alaska Department of Corrections interim leader to serve long-term as the agency's commissioner designee. That's according to the Alaska Beacon. The position is subject to confirmation by the legislature. Dunleavy, in a news release last week, announced the selection of Jen Winkleman, who has served in a variety of roles within corrections since 2001. Winkleman was named acting commissioner last May when Nancy Dahlstrom left the department to run for lieutenant governor. Corrections ended 2022 with a decade-high number of deaths, 18. All but one of them took place while Winkleman was acting commissioner. During a news conference in October, she said the deaths were not unusual. Corrections has faced criticism, though, and scrutiny over this high number of deaths, which includes several individuals in their 20s or 30s, or who died after only a short time in state custody. Senate and House members meet jointly, typically late in the legislative session, to vote on all of the governor's appointees. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Soldotna looks at creating a more walkable and business-friendly downtown.
Well, I think it's about a sense of place and connecting people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want to make a lasting impression? Consider planning a gift as a bequest to this station. Talk to a financial advisor to learn how. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
The Air Force has begun replacing Eielson Air Force Base's aging fleet of F-16s with upgraded models of the fighter jet. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the first two arrived last week.
The two newer F-16 Fighting Falcons are both about 35 years old, a couple of years younger than the jets they'll replace. But more importantly, the incoming F-16s have avionics updated 5 years ago, nearly a decade newer than the old jets.
So it's still the same airframe and engine. However, with the increase in systems capability upgrade, some of the software, the processors, all that has been replaced.
Lieutenant Colonel Albert Roper commands Eielson's 18th Aggressor Squadron, and he says the upgraded jets will enable his units to better train U.S. and Allied pilots to fight adversaries' advanced aircraft, including so-called fifth-generation fighters comparable to Eielson's F-35s.
Our daily training here is interactions with local fifth-gen aircraft in the state of Alaska, so both F-22s from down there at J-Bear, and then with the F-35s here at Eielson Air Force Base in order to keep them operationally proficient and combat ready.
The unit is called the Aggressor Squadron because its pilots often play the role of adversaries during training exercises held every year out of Eielson and J-Bear. Those include Red Flag and Northern Edge, both of which are conducted in the skies above the 65,000-square-mile Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex, a series of training ranges spread around the state.
The mission of the aggressors is to know the threat. We teach that threat to our combat air crews and their partner nations, and then we replicate that threat in the aircraft.
Roper says that training will continue over the next several months with both the new and old F-16s. And he says during that time, two or three of the newer jets will arrive every few weeks, and two or three of the older ones will then fly their final missions to the Aircraft Maintenance and Regeneration Center at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in southern Arizona, the so-called boneyard, where aircraft are stored before being sold or recycled.
By August or September of this year, hopefully the transition has been completed, and we've got our newer jets here, and our other ones are down at the boneyard, mothballed away.
Roper says Air Force officials hope to replace all 19 of the squadron's F-16s by the fall. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
It's been a winter for the record books when it comes to holiday travel. Snow, ice, and scheduling issues have snarled flights, stranding passengers for days or weeks. Alaska has largely been spared from the airline crisis, aside from the usual weather-related issues that hold up flights from time to time. But here in Alaska, the problems are on the water. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, the Alaska Marine Highway System's decision to pull the ferry Matanuska out of service has left some travelers stuck abroad.
Mary Lynn Dahl and her husband Jim love to ski in Smithers, British Columbia.
In total, I figured it out, we've done it over 160 trips. So we've been doing it for about 20 years.
The Ketchikan couple usually spends 2 to 3 weeks at their cabin in Smithers. After all, it's no small feat to get there. It's about 4 hours of driving through northern BC in the middle of the winter, and that's after a 7-hour ferry from Ketchikan to Prince Rupert. But it's always been worth it. All 9 of the Dahls' grandkids learned to ski in Smithers, plus a half dozen of their Ketchikan friends. This year, Mary Lynn says the Dahls planned a longer trip. They'd stay about 2 months since the Marine Highway System wasn't running any ferries in January.
In order to come down for Christmas to meet with our friends and our family who drives up from Seattle, we had to come down the early part of December, and we couldn't leave until February 7th.
Why no ferries in January? The Matanuska, the ferry that runs to Prince Rupert, was in the shipyard getting some work done. During its annual overhaul, crews spotted some concerning issues on the Matanuska. Deputy Transportation Commissioner Catherine Keith said at a recent Marine Highway Operations Board meeting that one problem is crumbling asbestos.
There has been always asbestos on board these aging vessels, and we know it's there. However, when asbestos becomes exposed or is friable, meaning it's in like a dust, that it is in the air, basically, then it becomes a health risk.
That stopped work immediately. The state, of course, doesn't want welders and pipe fitters breathing in cancer-causing dust. But crumbling asbestos wasn't the worst of what they found.
And in addition to that, during the overhaul, there was more discovered steel, which is going to increase the cost of this overhaul significantly and the amount of time that the vessel would be in overhaul.
Keith says repairs to the corroded steel will dramatically increase the cost of the overhaul. And she says the ferry service isn't sure what to do with the 60-year-old ship.
We would like to pause on our decisions for capital investments in this project to see what really is the wisest choice right now. This steelwork, it could increase the cost of this overhaul up to $8 or $10 million, and we're still trying to quantify that exactly.
That brings up a whole host of issues. The Matanuska has been the primary vessel serving the so-called mainline route through southeast Alaska. Its sister ships, the Taku and Malaspina, are both out of service. One was cut up for scrap, the other sold off as a floating museum. But for a more immediate concern...
ultimately, what these developments mean is that the Matanuska will not be able to be on our summer schedule.
Or the February schedule. The ferry service isn't totally out of options. Keith says the flagship ferry Columbia is coming off the bench to fill in.
The Columbia will now be on our schedule and sailing as soon as February 13th.
That's just a week after the Dahls were originally scheduled to sail home. No problem. They're retired. Anyone who's traveled in Alaska or northern Canada during the winter knows it's a good idea to plan for a bit of a cushion in case of delays. But the Columbia won't be going to Prince Rupert. It's not certified for international travel. And even if it was, it's too big to tie up at the Prince Rupert terminal. The other ship with the necessary certification to sail the Prince Rupert, the Kennecott, is scheduled to hit the shipyard in February for maintenance. So, a few days ago, Dahl says she got some bad news.
The ferry service called us and said that our ferry home from Prince Rupert to Ketchikan has been canceled, period. And there's no plan to replace it. We said, what? What are we supposed to do? We're down here and we have a ticket to come home.
Sure, they could fly home, but it's awfully hard to fly with a car full of ski stuff and 2 dogs. Airlines don't exactly take cars as checked baggage.
And they said, well, you know, there is no option. Unless you drive down to Bellingham. And I was a little shocked, to be honest with you.
Bellingham, Washington is the southernmost port on the Marine Highway System. It's also a 13-hour drive from Smithers in the summer.
So we are going to drive 700 miles to Bellingham from here in Smithers, where we're now. And then we have to get on the ferry a week later and go another 750 miles the other direction to get back to Ketchikan, which is kind of crazy.
The State Department of Transportation did not return interview requests or answer written questions before the story was first published, but a day after, spokesperson Shannon McCarthy provided a written statement. Close to 40 passengers and 20 vehicles had their tickets refunded or rebooked as a result of the Prince Rupert cancellations, according to McCarthy. Those reservations were spread over three sailings in February, March, and April. McCarthy says the ferry service doesn't reimburse for gas or lodging, and she confirmed that there are no plans to send a state ferry or private vessel to Prince Rupert to fill in for the Matanuska. So Mary Lynn and her husband are on their own.
It's really irritating. I know that these boats are old and I know they need maintenance, but that should be expected and planned. And because you've sold the tickets already, unless the boat is imminently going to sink, I think you should pick those people up and bring them home and then, you know, not proceed to keep running the boat. And plan a little bit better.
And she has some ideas. She says she'd like to see the ferry system upgrade more ships to handle the Prince Rupert route. And she says the Alaska legislature should find a way to insulate the Marine Highways budget from shifting political winds. But for now, she's planning for a long, cold drive south. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station.
A University of Alaska Fairbanks skier has picked up three medals so far at the World University Winter Games in Lake Placid, New York. Mariel Pullis of Estonia captured gold in the women's freestyle sprint last weekend. According to a UAF skiing news release, Pullis is the first Estonian to win a winter gold medal at the Games. Pullis additionally took silver medals in 5-kilometer classic and freestyle events Tuesday and Wednesday. Her UAF teammate Kendall Kramer of Fairbanks finished 12th and 11th in those races. The remainder of the cross-country competition schedule consists of relays Friday and mass start distance skate races on Sunday. The World University Winter Games brings together high-level collegiate athletes in a dozen sports. Boardwalks, bike lanes, and better business. The city of Soldotna is gathering all the ideas it can from residents and business owners before it puts together a plan to create a walkable, business-friendly downtown along the Kenai River, meant to bring more traffic to the underutilized riverfront area. The city held its first open house on the project last week. KDLL's Sabine Pooks was there and has this story.
Jason Graff is an urban designer with First 40 Feet, the Portland, Oregon-based consulting firm coordinating the project. He says his team's been talking to officials and property owners in Soldotna about what they'd like to see along the 85 acres between Soldotna Creek Park and the David Dothit Veterans Memorial Bridge.
And to shape it into a place where you all as a community want to spend time, where you feel excited about being in Soldotna.
The city of Soldotna has long identified riverfront redevelopment as a priority to better incorporate the river into the town and create a pedestrian-friendly downtown area in the once homestead hub. Last spring, the city got a grant from the U.S. Economic Development Administration to do that, starting an 18-month clock on the project. And at the open house, dozens of Soldotna residents and business owners marked on large maps where they love to spend time in town already and what they'd like to see change. Most at the session agreed. Creating a community that's more walkable and connects shops and restaurants is key. Megan Weston lives in Soldotna and is the former owner of Odie's, a sandwich shop that falls in the design area. She says there are some big properties near the west side of the project area that are currently in private hands.
I think really creating the walking space between Soldotna Creek and either one or both of those properties is going to make a huge difference. But it's going to take like the community standing up and saying, like, we want this and we're willing to put our money behind it.
Do you think we can do that as a community?
Absolutely. There's a lot that can be done in this community, both financially and energy-wise.
That patchwork of property ownership is one of the challenges to the project. The city says it will be key to partner with private property owners as it works out a plan going forward. Penny Vadla lives in the city and chairs the city's Parks and Recreation Advisory Board.
Well, I think it's about a sense of place and connecting people. And so I'd like to see a walkway, and if we could purchase as much land as possible, I would really like that, because I see people would start walking more and driving less. And I also think it's really important for kids to have that ability to see the river and see what it has to offer and have a safe place to be with family.
At the session, Graf, with the firm, identified several distinct spheres in the design area, including the eastern end, which has the park and is a hub for local businesses like Lucy's Market and Kenai River Brewing. Mel Allen says the project could be a boon for business. She owns Mel's Cafe on Kalifornsky Beach Road.
Right, yeah. Just having more businesses gathered closely together, I think, is going to be such a benefit to each one of them, you know, being able to walk from one to the next.
Allen's lived in Soldotna her whole life and says she's seen it grow and change a lot since she was a kid. At the open house, many pointed to Soldotna Creek Park, once a Department of Transportation yard, as the town's centerpiece. Allen says this project feels like an extension of that growth.
Yeah, like a really positive extension and much needed, I think.
Graf says they're planning to hold another public input session in the spring before they draw up a master plan for the project. The plan would go before the Soldotna City Council in October, according to the timeline provided by the firm. In Soldotna, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The Anchorage Folk Festival kicks off tonight, returning in full force after scaling back during the pandemic. Tonight's headliner is Mile 12, a bluegrass band out of Boston.
One, two, one, two, three. Heaven is a place where the good men go. Maybe it's a place that I won't know.
The group is known for singing fast and picking hard, which the festival's president, Johns Ostman, says will help get things off to a good start.
They take bluegrass where sometimes bluegrass doesn't go, and they're young and they're energetic.
Ostman says the festival is run completely by volunteers.
We have a real treat for the people in Anchorage, people of South Central Alaska. One, we haven't done this in a long time. We've worked really hard, our volunteers and our board of directors, to make sure that everybody has a really fun time.
The Anchorage Folk Festival's main stage is at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on the University of Alaska Anchorage campus. There are performances Friday, Saturday, and Sunday for both this weekend and next. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Kavitha George in Juneau, Catherine Rose in Sitka, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Sabine Pooks in Soldotna, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Madeline Rose is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Would you like to play a part in the public media you enjoy? Consider becoming a member or corporate sponsor. Contact your public radio station to learn how. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.